is every man's dream. Solomon had it all. His personal journal, Ecclesiastes, was an open confession of his unrelenting pursuit of happiness. Solomon surrounded himself with more wine, women, and song than any man could possibly handle. And the outcome failed to satisfy. Today on Insight for Living, you'll hear Chuck Swindoll present another message in our study through Solomon's book. It's a series we're calling Living on the Ragged Edge. Today, we're looking at the latter half of Ecclesiastes chapter 2, and we'll begin by reading the passage together. Chuck's message is titled, More Miles of Bad Road.
Solomon has told it all. He's been absolutely transparent with us, and without hesitation, he's even admitted his own frustrations. He was unable to find satisfaction in intellectual pursuits. You may also recall that he turned to wine, women, and song, only to enter into greater boredom. He tried personal projects, pools and parks, in well-scented areas. Again, no satisfaction. He attempted to be fulfilled with harems of beautiful concubines and hundreds of wives and even fine singers. Again, zero satisfaction. And that was only the beginning. But what did he find? More miles of bad road. That's what he found. New pursuits, same conclusions. If all the sensual delights and practical projects wouldn't produce lasting happiness, well, maybe a change in direction would. So, as we'll see in today's study, he tries that new direction. Let me read for you the portion from his journal out of the book of Ecclesiastes where Solomon writes about that new direction. I'll be reading from the New Living Translation Study Bible. Listen to chapter 2, verses 12 through 26. That's Ecclesiastes 2, 12 through 26. So I decided to compare wisdom with foolishness and madness. For who can do this better than I, the king? I thought, wisdom is better than foolishness, just as light is better than darkness. For the wise can see where they are going, but fools walk in the dark. Yet I saw that the wise and the foolish share the same fate. Both will die. So I said to myself, since I will end up the same as the fool, what's the value of all my wisdom? This is all so meaningless. For the wise and the foolish both die. The wise will not be remembered any longer than the fool. In the days to come, both will be forgotten. So, I came to hate life, because everything done here under the sun is so troubling. Everything is meaningless, like chasing the wind. I came to hate all my hard work here on earth, for I must leave to others everything I have earned. And who can tell whether my successors will be wise or foolish? Yet they will control everything I have gained by my skill and hard work under the sun. How meaningless! So I gave up in despair, questioning the value of all my hard work in this world. Some people work wisely with knowledge and skill, then must leave the fruit of their efforts to someone who hasn't worked for it. This too is meaningless, a great tragedy. So what do people get in this life for all their hard work and anxiety? Their days of labor are filled with pain and grief. Even at night, their minds cannot rest. It is all meaningless. So I decided there is nothing better than to enjoy food and drink and to find satisfaction in work. Then I realized that these pleasures are from the hand of God. For who can eat or enjoy anything apart from Him? God gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy to those who please Him. But if a sinner becomes wealthy, God takes the wealth away and gives it to those who please Him. This too is meaningless, like chasing the wind.
You're listening to Insight for Living. You'll find helpful Bible study tools that complement this series in Ecclesiastes by going to insightworld.org. And now the message from Chuck Swindoll, More Miles of Bad Road.
More often than not, ours is a problem of perspective rather than sight. Most of us have pretty good vision, but when it comes to seeing beneath the surface, we can be terribly blind. In that sense, we are quite unlike God. The ancient prophet Judge Samuel put it this way, "Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." He always looks beneath the surface. We always look on the surface. And by doing so, we have the ability within ourselves to hide the truth from one another. As Mark Twain put it on one occasion, we are all like the moon. We have a dark side we don't want anybody to see. Perhaps the reason that we are drawn so closely and intimately into the book of Ecclesiastes with such a great deal of interest is that it pulls no punches. It hides no secrets. It tells the truth about our lives. It says it like it is. If I could go back to a very familiar scene in this present day in which I speak, I would go to Wimbledon over in jolly old England, ivy-covered Wimbledon, the place of tennis lovers the world over, and the names that have appeared in that tournament are legend. Many, many more behind us than there are present on the surface today. But there is one man whose presence is conspicuous by its absence in the finals. He is sort of the pride of Argentina, a man of amazing charisma, of wonderful, wonderful crowd-pleasing abilities. In fact, one lady said who lived in Buenos Aires, "If I could but touch the hem of his garment, I could somehow find healing." Guillermo Vilas appears to be the epitome, the sine qua non of masculinity and of physical ability in the game of tennis. But in a private interview with some reporters from Sports Illustrated some time ago, Vilas admitted, "Fervently, I think that many times one feels oneself to be secure, and suddenly one's world falls down like a pack of cards in a matter of seconds." Athletes may look strong and may appear strong and may leave the fans screaming words of praise as they perform their feats. But how many of them in the off-season are insecure, strugglers, just people like you and I? Even those who make us smile have times like this. The cartoonist Ralph Barton, before he took his own life, left this note: "I have had few difficulties, many friends, great success. I have gone from wife to wife, from house to house, and have visited great countries of the world, but I am fed up with devices to fill up 24 hours of the day." As I read those words, I wondered if others haven't also thought them. Talk about emptiness. Dr. Walter Trobisch, before he died, was writing a book called The Misunderstood Man. And in it, he hides nothing. He talks about the frustrated man. He says the word frustrated comes from the Latin word frustra, which means in vain. In other words, one who is frustrated is one who feels that all he does is in vain. In spite of putting his whole strength into a project, he does not reach his goal, and he feels that everything he begins fails. A sense of inner helplessness overcomes him when he looks at the challenges which face him. We don't want people to know that. We want to appear secure and confident, successful, in charge, in touch. We want to have all of the handles, and we want to have hold of all those handles. We would rather lie than let the truth be known. I came across an interesting story that they tell in Africa about the chief who called all of his men to come to his hut in the center of the village. It was his fear, he said to them, that there were no longer any real men in the village. He had the impression that the men were being ruled too much by their wives. To find out if this were true, he asked all the men who felt that their wives bossed them around to leave the hut through the door on the right. Those who felt that they were in charge at home should leave through the door on the left. Lo and behold, all of the chief's men left through the door on the right, except one who stood all alone. He finally left through the door on the left. So the chief called the men together again and gave a speech of praise to the lone wolf. "At least we have one real man in our village," he said. "Could you please share with us your secret?" The man looked rather sheepish, and at last he muttered, "Chief, when I left home this morning, my wife said to me, 'Husband, never follow the crowd.'" Solomon in the book of Ecclesiastes writes a lot like that. He tells the truth. He tells the truth about chiefs as well as those who serve the chief. He tells the truth about kings and paupers, men and women, young and old. He tells the truth about slaves and free men. He tells the truth about life. He was able to do that. He had the position, he had the money, and he had the time it took to pursue what life was all about. And according to verse 13 of the first chapter, he confesses that he set his mind to seek and explore all that had been done under heaven. His pursuit was a horizontal pursuit. He was determined not to get beyond the sun or above the heavens, but to stay on this earth and to find out what he could about life and to find anything that would satisfy. Whatever was running for office, he would vote for it. Enough to pursue, to see if it was true, to see if that lake held water, to see if that dream had any purpose or any substance. He tried intellectualism in the latter part of chapter 1. He then turned to pleasure and laughter, and it fell flat. Later into chapter 2, he tried wine and women. He tried architecture and agriculture. Remember in our last study? He built parks, and he dug pools, and he planted trees, and he tried projects that affected the landscape of his nation. Nothing satisfied. He then turned to slaves, men and women, born within his own household as well as those that he would buy from outer nations. He listened to the songs of the singers. He collected precious metals and gems. He even went on all kinds of wild sexual escapades. He brought into his harem 1,000 women to see if that would satisfy. None of it satisfied. Verse 10 of chapter 2, he confesses, "All that my eyes desired, I didn't refuse them. I tried it all. I held nothing back. My pleasures were there. My heart was not withheld from any pleasure. It was pleased because of all my labor, and that was my reward. The momentary smile of ecstasy was the ultimate limit of my satisfaction. And then I returned to boredom. Then I looked for another bright light on the horizon." No prophet under the sun, verse 11 concludes. Well, there's another direction I should go. In fact, the way verse 12 of chapter 2 begins suggests a change in direction. So I turned. I came to a fork in the road, and I decided I would turn this direction, and I would pursue a number of comparisons. I would compare, for example, wisdom with foolishness. I would compare my world of work with an evening of relief. And I would try to find some meaning as to whether work would be worth it now or later. I would try the comparisons to see what I would choose. Beginning in this 12th verse, he comes to the first comparison. I determined whether I would be a man of wisdom or a man of folly. Verse 12, I considered wisdom against madness and folly. For what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? It's another way of saying, I'm the king, and I have the time and money and the skills and the wisdom to find out the answers. And who could find out more than I after me? So I will go the limit to discover the answer to this wisdom folly question. Is it really worth it to live with one's mind open, filled with the skills of one's ability and the hope of one's tomorrow? Or is it worth it simply to live like a fool in a darkened room? He comes to the conclusion in verse 13 that it's better to live wisely than foolishly. See the way it reads? I saw that wisdom excels folly as much as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool, he walks in darkness. His eyes are closed. He doesn't have his head in gear, we would say today. He doesn't go with things as they really are. He imagines things. His eyes are closed. There are no lights on. And he wanders and gropes to find meaning and purpose. It's better to be wise than to be foolish. It's better to have your eyes open than to have your eyes closed. And yet I know that one fate befalls them both. Isn't that interesting? When I look at the foolish compared to the wise, and I choose wisdom, suddenly I'm to another impasse, because death impacts both. In other words, if you live wisely, you're still going to die. You're going to put forth the effort to get a good education, to pursue a good job, to operate on the basis of good common sense. You're going to either practice a profession or carry out your trade. And you're going to live with your eyes wide open. You're going to raise your family, and you're going to do all the things that a wise person would do, planning for tomorrow. But the fact is, the axe falls on your neck just like it does on the neck of a fool. You're going to die. Verse 15, I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. I, the wisest of the wise. Why then have I been extremely wise? I think this is the way a person feels who has recently graduated from the university and cannot find a job. He's highly qualified and completely useless. It's a terrible feeling. He has a degree or maybe multiple degrees and he cannot find work. And he looks out on the world of fools and he sees most of them employed. And he says, what use is all this wisdom? What use are all these degrees? What's the meaning of it all? Why have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this is vanity. It's an empty dream, this pursuit of intelligence. Verse 16, there's no lasting remembrance of the wise man, as is true of the fool. Inasmuch as in the coming days, all will be forgotten. Oh, we try to keep that from happening. We don't build our tombstones out of cardboard. We build them out of granite. We don't paste names on them that are out of masking tape. We etch the names into the granite. And we dare the sands of time and the winds of time to beat upon that slate and to wear it thin. Because these are our loved ones and we never want them forgotten. But all tombstones finally wear down to thin pieces of slate and fall. I've seen them strewn across New England, and so have you. Well, then there are those in Egypt that have an answer. The answer is the pyramids. Let's see one of them fall. David Allen Hubbard has written a fine little book on Ecclesiastes, which he calls Beyond Futility. Listen to this. They were a wonder of the ancient world. And 45 centuries after they were built, we sons and daughters of a modern era still gaze at them in awe. The pyramids of Egypt, especially those at Giza, just outside Cairo, are massive monuments to ancient technology. The great pyramid of the pharaoh Khufu is staggering in size, nearly 500 feet tall. That's 50 stories. It contains about 2,300,000 blocks of solid stone, each of which weighs at least 2 tons. Many comparisons have been used to try to convey an accurate impression of the vastness of these pyramids. One scholar has suggested that within its base, there would be room for the great Italian cathedrals of Florence, Milan, and St. Peter's in the Vatican, as well as St. Paul's Cathedral and Westminster Abbey in London. Think of it. One of the most striking comparisons comes from Napoleon's time. While some of his generals climbed to the top of the Great Pyramid, the emperor waited below. He was smart, wasn't he? He waited below, calculating the mass of stone in the three pyramids that jut up from the Giza Plateau. When his generals descended, Napoleon is said to have greeted them with this startling announcement. "Men, if all the stone in the three pyramids could be exported to France, it would serve to build a wall 10 feet high and 1 foot thick around the entire country of France." Don't tell me that we die and forget one another. Let's build a pyramid. Let's build them so that those that are related to the sun god can somehow ascend and find their way into heaven and be remembered forever. Solomon says, don't waste your time on a pyramid. They'll soon be forgotten. Only a few ancient history buffs would even be able to name the pharaohs, much less tell what their tombs were like. They're all forgotten. It's vanity. Verse 16 concludes how the wise man and the fool alike die. Look at the next phrase. So I hated life. You ever felt like that? Don't answer all at once. It'll just blow the walls out of this place. It's the word of absolute disgust. I hated life. For the work which had been done under the sun, there's that phrase again, under the sun, was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after wind.
More Miles of Bad Road. That's the title Chuck Swindoll assigned to his sermon today. There's obviously much more from Ecclesiastes chapter 2 we need to consider, and we urge you to follow along with this important series on Insight for Living. It's called Living on the Ragged Edge. Find it online at insightworld.org. This 24-part study in Ecclesiastes has been tagged as a classic series at Insight for Living. And that means you'll receive all 24 sermons on CD, along with a bonus conversation with Chuck and a Bible Companion study guide. It's not too early to place your pre-order for the series Living on the Ragged Edge at insight.org. And if you've never contacted Insight for Living, we'd like to send you a free CD containing a message from Chuck Swindoll. It's called Encouragement Served Family Style. It's our gift to you, hoping you'll benefit from the practical instruction contained in Chuck's sermon. Ask for the free CD, Encouragement Served Family Style, when you contact us. If you're listening in the United States, call right now 1-800-772-8888 or visit us online at insight.org. Well, time is running out to take advantage of this month's special selection. Chuck hand-selected a thought-provoking book by trusted author Jerry Bridges called The Pursuit of Holiness. Becoming a Christian happens instantly at the point of conversion, but the gospel cannot be contained to one single moment. We live out the gospel every day, and we're becoming molded and shaped into Christ's likeness all along the way. Well, Jerry's book is about the exciting and rewarding pursuit of holiness. We'll provide a copy when you give a donation of any amount to Insight for Living. We want this book to serve as a tangible reminder of our partnership in ministry together. Ask for the book, The Pursuit of Holiness. If you're listening in the United States, call right now 1-800-772-8888. And online, go to insight.org.
I will never forget the first time Cynthia and I drove around the bend and we saw the holy city for the very first time. It literally took our breath away.
And now you can see Jerusalem for yourself with Chuck and Cynthia Swindoll on the Insight for Living Israel Tour, March 2014.
My first trip to Israel was much later in life than it should have been. I've never regretted that journey or any of those that followed. In fact, I wish it had all happened sooner.
Imagine hearing the Bible teaching you've come to respect on Insight for Living on location in Israel.
No pastor, no follower of Christ should ever pass up an opportunity to see, and to touch, and to fall in love with the very places where biblical history unfolded.
You have a lot of choices, but there's only one tour with Chuck Swindoll and Insight for Living, March 10th through the 21st, 2014, with an optional pre-tour Red Sea experience, March 7th through the 11th. Call 888-447-0444. That's 888-447-0444. Or visit us online at insight.org/events.
The Insight for Living tour to Israel is paid for and made possible by only those who choose to attend.
Chuck Swindoll's study in Ecclesiastes, Living on the Ragged Edge, continues Friday, right here on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, More Miles of Bad Road, was copyrighted in 1983, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2013 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide.